Welcome to Money Talks. My name is Mike Campbell. I better say this up front in case I forget that Happy New Year. Glad you're with us. So we got, it's going to be a big year. As I consistently say, 2023 is going to be more chaotic than 2022. So hang on to your hats. By the way, I don't think I've ever been able to start a show like this as I don't only have a shocking stat. I got a shocking miracle, and I'll give the details later on in the show, but I've also got Lance Roberts with me. I want to dig into his brain about what are we looking at, what we should be doing, all of those things. I've got Andrew Rulin on with me also. He's going to give us specifics about what individuals do approaching a market with this much volatility. I've got Ozzy, of course. I've got Michael Levy. He was not with us last week, so the big question for me is, hey, what was your top story? You know, how does it play into 2023? And of course, Victor Adair, so much more. Of course, we got a Goofy. I've got a shock, as I say, shocking miracle, I'm going to call it, and a Goofy Award. But first, before I get to a quick comment, I have to go back for a moment to last week's Year in Review, where I chose as my top story the continued push for censorship and the curtailment of free speech. I thought it was a pretty safe bet that I was probably the only one in the country who would have named that the top story of the year, especially when there's so many other deserving candidates. I mean, rising cost of living, energy crisis, Russian invasion and sanctions, escalating geopolitical tensions with both Russia and China, and they're all with us still. But I thought those were deserving candidates, but predictable. So I continue to come away with the impression that a lot of people don't seem to appreciate the profoundly negative impact on progress or innovation or raising our standard of living, social harmony, of restricting speech and the no questions allowed attitude surrounding a growing number of issues. I mean, no matter where you stand on that issue, you should be aware that there are millions of people who believe that the only opinions that should be aired are those they agree with. Now, I promise I'm not going to rehash the issue other than to point out that it only took a few days to get a shocking example of how far we've come down the road of censorship. When one of Canada's best-known Canadians, Dr. Jordan Peterson, was informed by the Ontario College of Psychologists that he must submit to mandatory social media communication retraining with government-approved experts for crimes like criticizing climate change models, objecting to surgery on gender dysphoric minors, stating it was wrong for social service workers and police to threaten to apprehend the children of the trucker convoy protesters, as well as he was sending out tweets or retweeting stuff from the official opposition. He's been critical of the prime minister. And why? This is incredible. Because the College of Psychologists received about a dozen complaints over 4 years, and not one of them from a current or former patient. And they said, though, his views harmed them. And by the way, they didn't actually say that. They didn't harm them in particular, but they did harm people. And by the way, I get that many complaints after every podcast, not 12 in 4 years, but that's not the point. The point is whether you agree or disagree with Dr. Peterson, the issue is whether a government-sanctioned body should be threatening him with professional sanctions because somebody doesn't like his views. And you think this is far out there? Be aware that Bill C-36 promises more of the same. Now, I'm not going to go on and on, but you really got to hear this from the Ontario Civil Liberties take on the bill. In quotes, criminal conduct in this case is speech in which no actual harm to any specific person needs to be proven by the state, nor does the anticipated criminal speech involve incitement of a crime, but rather incitement of hatred, an emotion which is not in itself a crime. Now, here's the part you should know. The bill will amend the Canadian Human Rights Act to permit investigations of complaints, including anonymous complaints against anybody, any blogger, publisher, social media, that kind of thing. And, you know, that they say that it's likely to foment detestation or vilification. I mean, you can get fined $20,000, got to pay $50,000 more to government. My point is, this is how far down the road of censorship we've got. We should pay attention. Just one quick question, though, for those people who support censorship. Do you think you hold an opinion on any hot button issue that someone may disagree with? Because my point is, why don't you think you could be next? You know, it brings me to something else here, and that's the changing political divide in this country. And I think most Canadians feel the country is divided. It may be different opinions. It may be because it's urban. It might be rural. It might be maybe that traditional workers versus business kind of thing, a French, English, that kind of thing. But as Liberal MP in Quebec City, Joel Lightbound stated, That was actually the goal. From a positive and unifying approach, he says, a decision was made to wedge, to divide, and to stigmatize. Well, I'll tell you, where did they do that? They do that in terms of personal rights versus sort of collective rights. And I love this quote by Pitchfork Papers' Stephen Wilkinson. He says, this divide is neither the old-time left versus right. It's free state versus security state. I mean, we on the one side, you've got individuals fighting to maintain their rights versus the steady encroachment of government on individual rights, like free speech, with the declared goal of enhancing public safety. I mean, isn't that what the last few years under the pandemic were all about? It was, we're going to lock you down. Now, there's no scientific evidence to support it. In fact, it's been greatly discredited, but we'll do it because we're going to protect you. You've got to have a vaccine. Well, we're going to protect you. It's all about protecting. And as I say, that continues, by the way. I mean, it's really well illustrated when you look at the three bills that the Liberal government have presented, internet, social media censorship, because they've got to protect the public from misinformation. I mean, it goes on and on. And I'm just pointing out here that the divisions are rising out of the pandemic. We're not the traditional left-right. We're not the traditional urban versus rural. I'm not saying they don't have a part to play, but I'm just bringing to your attention, it is as much about state security and public safety versus individual rights and the push for things like censorship or other new guidelines. I mean, we just got guidelines saying, hey, you got to buy an electric vehicle starting in 2025. And by 2035, y'all got to own electric vehicles if you're buying a new car. That's typical. So I think this divide and this tension in the country, well, there's a lot more to come. And speaking of more to come, keep in mind, we've got the Outlook conference coming up. I promised I would be talking about it a lot, but it really is the best lineup of speakers I think we've ever had. And it's February 3rd and 4th in person, Bayshore Hotel in Vancouver, February 3rd and 4th. I just don't think you can afford to miss it. It's really important stuff. We can give you more updates on Money Talks tweets and Michael Campbell's Money Talks Facebook, but go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. Get your ticket. I look forward to seeing you there. Much more to come today. Really pleased to welcome back to the show, realinvestmentadvice.com. I invite you to go to the website because you can read the blog, you can read the newsletter, all sorts of things there. And because Lance Roberts is there, one of my favorite analysts. Great to have you with us. Happy New Year, by the way, and thank you for finding time.
Absolutely, Michael. So glad to be here.
Well, and I know this is the time of year. It's not like I had to be a genius to know what to ask you. What do you see for 2023? But I did want to start. We got the Fed minutes earlier this week, telling us, I still think they're a little more hawkish than the market seems to assume. You know, so is that still the key determinant? I mean, is that still what the market's all focusing on? And other things really are number four, five, and six when it comes to determining what market action is.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, just take a look, for example, like the recent employment numbers. We got the ADP report out and markets sold off a little over 1% because the number was a lot stronger than expected. And of course, that means the Fed's going to have to keep hiking rates. We get the BLS employment report the following day and the market's up over 1% because wages came in a little bit weaker than expected, which means, well, maybe the Fed won't have to hike as much. So we just go from one report to another going, okay, what does this mean for what the Fed's going to do? Are they going to hike rates? Are they going to slow down? Are they going to pivot? And it's nonsense. I mean, we no longer pay attention to fundamentals or, you know, the actual, market valuations. You know, it's all about what is the Fed going to do next? And that's a problem for investors. It's okay for traders because you just trade from one report to the next. But for an investor, it makes it very difficult.
Yeah, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but we've been saying on Money Talks for a couple of years, the year we were looking at was 223, that we thought 222 would be chaotic, volatile, and I keep repeating this, but we thought really for over 2 years that 223 would be worse. And now we get all the geopoliticals coming more into focus, at least the dangers and stress. The stress in the financial system is more obvious, and that to me is going to be overwhelming. So we can see why maybe the models are sort of pointing to this year. And that's why, I mean, I just think it's a tough time for advisors and a tough time for investors.
Oh, it is. And look, I mean, you know, trying to manage money in this type of environment is difficult because, you know, what works one week or even one day doesn't work the next day. you know, one day technology is on fire, the next day it's selling off and going to new lows. And again, it's just, you know, it all comes back to, you know, is the Fed going to hike rates? Are they going to reduce their balance sheet? You know, and kind of the big thing this year, Michael, has been every report is like, okay, does this mean the Fed's going to pivot? You don't want the Fed to pivot. And the reason is that when the Fed actually pivots and they start cutting rates, they don't do it gradually, by the way. When they start slashing interest rates, it's because they broke something economically. That's not the time that you want to own stocks, is when the Fed pivots. So, you know, the bulls are kind of hoping for the worst case scenario, which is the Fed's going to start cutting rates, which means I can buy stocks. But that's going to be the point to where they're selling off drastically because something's broken economically.
I hope everyone's listening closely. You know, I'm serious, you know, because I thought, and I was chatting with Victor a couple of weeks ago about this, I thought the Fed gave us every indication about which they prefer. They don't mind breaking something because Jerome Powell said, well, we've got ways to handle that, you know, which we've seen over the last couple of years. But if inflation runs away, we don't have a way of changing people's psychology that way. And I just think it's important. But it is that weird environment where, oh, it's bad news. That's great. You know, because as you say, they're all focusing on if it's bad enough news, they'll finally stop this raising and maybe even drop. And as you say, and I just think it's such an important point, I'm not so sure you want to be in the markets at that point.
Exactly. Well, you know, and again, you know, when we kind of take a, you know, look at, you know, where we are economically, right? So everybody's predicting a recession for 2023. This will be the most well-forecasted recession ever, right? That everybody's expecting one. Well, okay, so even if we just assume we're expecting a recession, that means earnings estimates are way too high. Those have got to come down dramatically. And if earnings estimates come down, that means prices have to come down or valuations go up. So, you know, really, no matter how you look at 2023, you know, it just seems to me that the risk of more correction in the markets, and that doesn't mean the market ends, you know, the year negative, right? We could actually end the year on a positive note. But we could have a fairly sharp sell-off between now and midsummer if we start actually seeing the impact of what the Fed's doing. And the whole goal of the Fed is to hike rates, to slow economic growth. That brings down inflation. Well, if you're bringing down economic growth, that reduces earnings. So it just seems to me there's a real challenge here for stock prices to try to go higher in this environment.
Well, I think that's a great point because you look at the valuations. Obviously, we went crazy in certain sectors of the market, you know, types of tech, even senior tech. You know, I mean, those valuations, my longstanding and people roll their eyes joke was, you know, Peloton was fairly priced as long as we all had one in our bathroom, our living room, our den. People who've got mobility problems still bought two of them, you know. So I think that valuation question is one to focus on, though. Because I'm not so sure we've returned to even, oh boy, that's an attractive valuation, let alone if we do get downside pressure and earnings drop, you know, because of higher interest rates, maybe energy costs, whatever. I think that's getting overlooked.
No, I absolutely agree with you. You know, the one thing we have to look at is on top of that is when you start talking about valuations, right? You know, we had a big run up in stock prices in 2020, 2021. Okay, so why did we have that? Well, we had that because the Fed cut rates to zero. They're doing $120 billion a month in QE. But also, we did $5 trillion worth of stimulus sent directly to households. And this got all these millennials in parents' basements, you know, on the Robinhood app buying stocks. Of course, we had the whole meme stock thing going up, AMC, GameStop. And then, of course, you know, one SPAC. We couldn't get IPOs out fast enough. So we started doing these SPACs, which have all gone bad now. But the point is that in order to have a return to that type of market, to where prices are going up and people are buying stocks, not really care about earnings, you need all the things that are missing, which is the Fed is tightening their balance sheet. They're doing quantitative tightening, $95 billion a month this year. They're hiking rates, not reducing rates. That's tightening monetary policy. There is no more liquidity coming into the system. You know, that's why housing prices are correcting, sales are slowing down. You know, everything you need to boost asset prices higher is running in reverse right now. And this is why it's kind of interesting to me that so many investors are trying to run into the market to buy stuff, hoping to catch a bottom. You know, we had FOMO, fear of missing out, when markets were running up. Now we've got the FOMO of missing the bottom. Everybody's trying to just wants to bottom tick the market. And I think you're way too early here.
Well, the other thing is that I think the Federal Reserve has been very clear. They have a direct correlation. They make a direct correlation between stock prices and mm-hmm. the sort of robustness in the economy. So if they want inflation down and they want to slow the economy, which is clearly spelled out, they actually can't have a decent market. No, please disagree, you know, but I'm saying that's what I've taken from some of the stuff they've said. It's like Victor and I talked about a week ago. I said, why aren't we believing the Fed? We believe them on the way up and we're not believing them on the way down. But I think they've made it clear. We don't want the market up there. We don't want your house price up there. We don't want your collectibles, your NFTs. We don't want anything up there. So exactly. I don't think it's mission accomplished yet for them.
No, it's not. In fact, it's interesting you said that, because actually in this weekend's newsletter that I'm writing right now, I'm talking about, the bulls keep coming in wanting to run asset prices up. That's exactly the opposite of, to your point, of what the Fed wants. What they want is tighter monetary policy. Well, we have to go back to 2010 for a moment. You know, let's go back in the time machine here, 10 whole years. Ben Bernanke, in 2010, when he launched the second round of quantitative easing after the financial crisis, he said, the reason we're doing this is to boost asset prices, because if asset prices go up, people have a wealth effect and they'll go out and spend money in the economy, and that'll get the economy back on track. So higher asset prices make people feel better about spending money. Fast forward to today. The Fed saying, hey, I want to slow the economy down. And the bulls are going, okay, but if you pivot, stock prices are going to go up. So they run prices up. In August of 2022 at Jackson Hole, Jerome Powell had a speech prepared. 15 minutes before he was supposed to give a speech, he tore it up, wrote another one that basically said, I'm not stopping hiking rates. And the whole point was to bring asset prices down. And he did. We had a fairly decent correction. Then we get, in October, get oversold. Bulls start running up the market again, going, hey, maybe they're going to pivot. Jerome Powell comes out in December. Nope, we're not pivoting. Stock prices down again. So the Fed has been clear, to your point. We don't want higher asset prices because that eases financial conditions, exactly the opposite of what we're trying to achieve. They want to control, they don't want to crash markets, but they want to control burn of asset prices to a lower level to bring down these inflationary pressures.
So where does that leave the individual? Obviously we can't give specific advice. People have different circumstances, different ages, different risk profiles, that kind of thing. So I know I'm asking a very broad-based question, but we've been preaching defensiveness here for quite a while, and happy to do it. But that's because that is my nature. We bring Victor on because we want someone crazy. No, because we want a trader. No, because we want a trader. And he laughs at me all the time because I'm so, I'm so careful. But really, where does it leave? When I say let's be defensive, if you agree with that sort of general broad brush, what does that mean for individuals? Because I don't like that. Well, I lost a lot of money. I didn't lose any money in the bond market because we thought it was horrendous. We've been very accurate on that. But I'm just saying, somebody in the bond market said, okay, well, I'm out of stocks. I'm in bonds now. Oh, that's too bad. wear a black armband.
Well, the thing about owning bonds is, sure, bonds went down in price last year because interest rates went up. But if you own the individual bonds, right, who cares? Because the bonds mature at face value. And it's interesting because, when the market was running up and we were really overvalued in 2020-ish, right, I had people call me up and go, Lance, if I could just get 4% of my money, I'd be happy, right? You can go buy a one-year treasury, two-year treasury right now, get 4.5% on your money for 2 years. And so if you're willing to just sit on the sidelines and you're happy with 4.5%, there's nothing wrong with that, right? But the problem is psychologically, as individuals, as soon as the market takes off, we're going, why do I own these bonds at 4.5%? Market's going up 6-7% a day, right? So, we're always drugged by these emotional biases. But here's the point to your answer to your question. Look, we're real underweight stocks right now. We have some of our core long-term holdings that we love. We have a really short duration in our bond portfolio right now. And look, we're going to get to an opportunity this year. I think that bonds are going to outperform stocks by the end of this year for a whole variety of reasons. Because if the Fed gets their wish, you're going to have disinflation in the economy, and that's going to be great for yields. So we've got short duration here, but we'll probably lengthen that duration a little later on this year. But we've got almost 40% cash in our portfolios. And again, we're just waiting for opportunity. There's no reason to be running around chasing everything, trying to nip the bottom here, because there's no evidence that we're close to a bottom yet. Yes, look, we're oversold right now. we could very have a good rally here over the next month or two, and the markets wouldn't surprise me at all. But all these rate hikes, now I want you to hear this very clearly. There's about a 9 to 12 month lag time for interest rate hikes. The first rate hike from zero was a quarter basis point last March. So if we just assume there's a 12-month lag, the first rate hike won't even show up in the economy until March of this year. So these rate hikes aren't even in the system yet, and we're going, the bear market's over. You haven't even gotten to the impact of what the Fed's been doing yet, and there's now 4.5 percentage points of rate hikes that have not matured into the system yet. That's going to be slower economic activity, lower housing prices, lower access to credit, all these type of things. And that's going to feed right through to corporate earnings. So again, be a little bit cautious here. If you're really scared about the market and you're happy with 4%, go buy a treasury. See you next year. we'll do this. But, you know, I think you've got time to be patient here.
But I think your point also in that, in wrapped up in that, is short term. You know, I mean, yeah. I'm saying I'm worried about longer term for a lot of reasons. And, but I'm just saying, by the way, I wasn't that guy phoning you and saying, hey, if I get 4%, but I was the guy who phoned and said, hey, if I can get 5% in a 1 year, I'm in. You know, I'm literally, you know, and that was where I parked some money. You know, we went up to in Canada, you know, I got some stuff out of our major banks at 4.85, you know, and yeah. And with even with a redemption clause, you know, in case the market did drop 9,000 points or something and I wanted to get in, redemption clause, it still brought it up. But I think your point about cash and caution, there are things to do. I find it much easier than to say the same thing and say, I'll park my money for 0.5%, if you know what I mean. Yeah. You know, we're getting rewarded for that patience much better than we have in about 5-6 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, look, the whole thing is that we get too wrapped up in, and this is the media's fault, you know, to be honest with you, Michael, because it's like, oh, what, you didn't beat the market this year? Well, you got to be in, you know, you need to change advisors. You got to do all this other stuff. You know, we got all wrapped up in this really short-term narrative of the market that we've got to do this. We've got to be beating this today and doing this tomorrow. That's not the point of investing. The point of investing is to grow our savings. We worked really hard for our money, and then we just kind of gamble with it in the markets. And so the whole point is to make this money grow over time. And that means sometimes just being in cash and waiting for the right opportunity. You don't run out and just buy a house every day. You wait for the right deal to come along. And that's the same thing that you should be looking at in your portfolio. Where is the best place to put cash? If there's not a place, cash is fine. It provides opportunity and liquidity. And this is we need to focus on the important facts about what money means and how to invest it.
Well, seriously, I'm thrilled with what you're saying here. This is the Money Talks approach, you know, that, I mean, I've been around. I've seen, you know, I was an old guy in 1987 with the crash, you know what I mean? So I've seen a lot in that way. Every day I wonder if I've learned anything, but I have seen some. But let me just finish. I know I've kept you a little longer. Let me just fire a couple of things at you. Gold, for example.
Look, I have nothing against gold right now. Gold's a little bit overbought short term. It's had a nice little run here lately. Did not act as an inflation hedge in 2022 by any stretch of the imagination. You know, gold for us is a commodity, and we trade it as commodity. And what gold responds to is real yields, and that's yields minus inflation. And right now, there's a big divergence between gold and real yields. And either one is going to catch up to the other. Either gold prices will catch down to real yields, or the Fed is about to break something, and you're going to have a big drop in inflation, which will bring real yields up to gold, and gold will go higher. So, you know, if you really want kind of a measure of gold in your portfolio, watch real yields. That pretty much tells you everything you need to know.
And just quickly, again, I didn't mention this up top, but you're in Houston right now chatting with us, right. You know, obviously concerned on a, you know, sort of like Alberta, but the whole world's found out that energy is important. That's, you know, if there was sort of an easy lesson from the 2022, it was, and shockingly, some people needed to learn it. You know, I mean, I'm still flabbergasted by that, but where are you at with the oil market right now? Stocks and the commodity.
Yeah. So in November of 2021, you know, remember in 2021, we had oil prices go negative and nobody wanted to own energy stocks. Everybody hated them. And so November, we said, hey, buy energy stocks. This is going to be a great trade for next year. In 2022, oil stocks were up 40%. The market was down 20, rough numbers. That type of divergence of performance won't last forever. Here's a couple of things. Oil prices are coming down. They're getting a little bit oversold. I wouldn't be surprised to see a bounce here in oil prices short term. Drillers and some of the smaller oil and gas companies are oversold. I think they're due for a bounce. However, I put a big caveat around that. This is a tradable opportunity because if the Fed gets their wish and we have a recession and a slowdown economically, that's going to reduce demand and oil prices will come down. And obviously, since energy stocks are priced against the commodity, energy stocks have to come down. And interestingly enough, like gold and real yields, there right now there's a very big gap between energy stocks and the price of the commodity, and that's got to close. And so either oil prices are going to catch up with energy stocks or energy stocks will catch down to oil prices. But, you know, again, you just need to be a little careful here. I still like energy stocks, but after that massive outperformance this year, I would be looking more towards things that everybody hates this year for potentially some potential outperformance.
Great stuff as usual. I'm smiling there thinking I've broken my rule. I don't like guests who are better than the host, but no. Lance,
Michael.
Well, Lance, thank you so much for finding time. Look forward to chatting again. I know you're busy. Realinvestmentadvice.com. But here's the great thing. You can go on it like right now, you know, whenever you're listening. And Lance writes their newsletter. He's on their blog, you know, writing pieces. So he's able to update. And it's absolutely free. Take advantage of it. Lance, thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it.
I want to bring Mike Levy in here right now, but I'm going to start with this, Mike. First of all, Happy New Year. Glad you're back with us. But you weren't with us for the year in review. If you think you're getting away with not telling me what your top story is, you're dead wrong. That's where I want to start. When you look back on 2022, what sort of jumps out as your top story?
I have one word for you, Mike. Transitory. That's it. Top story. And it goes back to 2021 also.
Yeah, and it's because obviously... that's the message we were getting right through into December. Hey, don't worry about this inflation thing. It's transitory. And that, of course, when you find people's main concerns are cost of living, other things around that, it kind of, that's just one of the more obvious examples of how our central bankers and politicians didn't get it right.
They didn't, Mike. And, you know, they may come back and say, well, it is transitory. It's just that transitory period wasn't weeks or months. It's going to end up being years. So I guess historians are going to say, what's your definition of transitory?
Well, yeah, I remember saying on air with you, because you were concerned about that months ago, you were talking about it. And I just said, well, you remember, the Roman Empire was transitory too. So it's a can't miss adjective. But your point's well taken, because here we are going into the new year. The old debate's the new debate. And that is, of course, we've had Federal Reserve minutes come up this past week. We had meetings of both Bank of Canada, U.S. Federal Reserve in December. It seems like the debate hasn't changed. You know, it's still about inflation. It's about what the Fed's going to do and Bank of Canada is going to do in response to inflation numbers. Yeah, it's just like more of the same.
And what I'm finding, Mike, now is, yes, it is more of the same. And you added, you know, other reasons for inflation, the supply chain problem, the amount of money that the government was dumping on the economy in both the U.S. and Canada, Europe too. But in November of 2021, Powell started just change his tone a little bit, started talking about, well, we may have to raise interest rates. And the Bank of Canada was there too, but never, Mike, in the whole time, as hawkish as Powell was.
But it's interesting that we talk about the pivot. Everyone talks about the pivot, but Mike, very few people define it. You know, I mean, like it's going to be like transitory in that way. Like for some people that say, oh, the Fed, you know, the economy's going to slow sufficiently, so we're going to get a pivot. But okay, so what's that mean? And what do you take away with that?
Well, there's many meetings for pivot, but the two that I do is we're going to pivot and go the other way. And that's sort of the hopeful one. Okay, we're going to get to that magic number. It's going to be there for a month or two or three, then pivot, and we're coming right back down. Or we're going to pivot, stop, and then observe for some time what the effect of the higher interest rates is, and then maybe we can get that pivot to mean we're going to start to lower rates. That's the camp I'm in, Mike.
Yeah, and that's the one that's got more convincing evidence for me too. And again, the time frames have shifted. I mean, the markets change, of course, but the time frames really have shifted. I think now, you know, there's an awful lot of people saying, well, we're going to keep this sort of level of rate. And when we had the Federal Reserve banker from Minnesota, I think earlier in the week, I think it was off the top of my head, it was Wednesday, came out and said, well, he's looking at 5.4% and then a pause. You know, that's in the pause camp. And to be fair to the central bankers, they've said this is data driven. And we know that a lot of the things that happened are lagged. You know, the impact isn't felt for a few months. So, you know, that may well be the case. But we're still not there at the top. I don't think many people are thinking there isn't another rate increase to come. And the central banks certainly say there's at least another one to come.
And this is where I'm shifting now from Powell to Macklem. I think the Bank of Canada has a much better handle on what's going on. That's my opinion. Macklem was saying we might get another quarter point, and I think that's going to be in. But he, I think, is willing to stop at a level of where they are now at this level and see what the impact's going to be over the weeks and months to come. That might be enough. And we've got Powell. And I know you know this part. We've got Powell on just a little different trajectory.
You know, it's important, I think, to understand, because we throw around words like recession without, I think, stopping for a moment and see how complicated the measure of that is. You know, for example, I bump into someone in Texas and I say, oh, you're in the real estate market. How's your market? We're in a deep recession. Oh, you're in the oil industry. Oh, we're in a boom. You know, that kind of thing. It is so right. complicated, so many variables. I mean, we saw Amazon this week say 18,000 layoffs from the corporate suite. You know, we had Salesforce do a big layoff. We've talked about the layoffs before. But at the same time, I'm looking at other numbers that say for every person that's unemployed in the States, there's 1.7 jobs waiting. That's not recessionary, and that's not a recessionary pressure. So, but it's because some industries are hiring, some industries aren't. Some regions are strong, some regions aren't. So I don't want to be so glib, you know, and spit out things like those words without just acknowledging the complexity of what we're talking about.
And it's very complex. And I think you've nailed it. It's certain industries. But I think both the Bank of Canada and the U.S. Federal Reserve agree that employment numbers have to soften. And I don't know what sector is going to carry that down. The fact that Amazon laid off, well, they've hired well over a million people during the boom of the past, 18 months until things slowed right down. So they're going to let some thousands go. But I mean, that's fine. But Mike, where is it going to be? Who's it going to impact? And are we going to get a recession? My thoughts are we are, but it's not going to be a deep recession. And again, I'm particularly more positive or less negative for Canada than the U.S.
But again, a good point you're making that, you know, the other big debate out there, as I say, recession is now sort of, or an economic slowdown is now in the sort of consensus, but the degree of it is certainly not. You know, you've got people saying this is going to be severe and ugly, some very good analysts. You've got others who are very good saying, no, I think it's going to be soft. You know, it's not going to be as abrupt as people think. And again, I think it comes down to how we're measuring it, the level of complexity of the economy, all of those things. The good news, you and I just get to wait and see. Just like the central banks have said they're going to do, they're waiting and seeing for the data.
Absolutely. And I know it's grist for the mill, my dad used to say, the thing that we can chew on for quite some time. But Mike, it is so important. And it's people's livelihood. It's what they're going to do as far as housing is concerned. Can they buy that new car? Can they afford the groceries? I think this is a very important discussion going forward.
Absolutely. And I'll be looking at employment. I think they are, you know, and again, this whole stat that 1.7 jobs are going wanting for every one person who's out of a job, I think that's still going to play, you know, the great retirement that we're hearing about, you know, that people haven't come back to work. It's all of that stuff in play. But the good news, Mike, is you and I'll be able to watch it every week and come back and chat about it.
Absolutely, Mike. Have a good weekend.
By the way, I think that sounded like a threat to people. Levy and Campbell are going to be back every week talking about this stuff. No, don't worry. We'll have other subjects. Mike, happy 2023.
You too, Mike. Thank you.
Time now for the quote of the week. You know, with all the uncertainty and the intense volatility, the overhang of a monetary and sovereign debt crisis, we got an energy crisis, increasing political tensions, all the while the Financial Times says last year, 2022, was the worst year for investors since 1871. So I don't think it's a surprise that a lot of people are very concerned. That's the backdrop for today's quote of the week from Martin Armstrong, who is controversial to say the least, but I think it's because of his bluntness and failure to toe the line for the establishment. While for others, he's revered for his model's uncanny accuracy in forecasting major events, many times to the exact day, like he did with the fall of the Berlin Wall, said that 3 years earlier, or the top of the Nikkei Index in 1989 in Japan, or the bottom of the pandemic decline, March 23rd, 2020. Marty's going to be with us at the World Outlook Conference, February 3rd and 4th, to give his forecast for, it could be geopolitics, the various markets, talking about like the US dollar, stocks, gold, bond, etc. And I think it's fair to say that he's not been surprised by anything we've been seeing, which is what makes this quote of the week on the political changes to come so interesting as we head into 2023. In quotes, "This is no time to get depressed. We have a lot to do. We will survive. There is a new door opening to revise what kind of government we'll leave for our posterity." These come every 309.6 years or so. The last one was the death of monarchy. This one will be republics, the most corrupt form of government known in history. As I say, always a lot to think about when you deal with Martin Armstrong, and I think you'll find him fascinating if you join us at the World Outlook Conference. That's February 3rd and 4th. It's coming right up on us, but one of the real treats is to get a chance to listen to the man the Wall Street Journal called the highest paid financial advisor in the world, but someone who's absolutely consulted with government sovereign wealth funds, etc. Always fascinating. Well, that's really interesting. It's fascinating, as I said with Michael earlier, that, you know, there is this big debate about central banks controlling everything. You know, we're all watching. Are they going to go, raise further? Are they going to drop? Are they going to stay the same? All of that thing. But, you know, I want to come back, Alla, what Lance was saying too, and I want to talk about what you should be doing about it. So I'm going to bring in Andrew Rulin right now, Integrated Wealth Management in Calgary. Andrew, first of all, Happy New Year, and thank you for finding time.
My pleasure, and same to all the listeners.
So let's talk about, individuals here and, just an overview of what you look at. I mean, do you start with the questions like, hey, is there a big recession coming? Is inflation going to slow down? Is the Fed going to, at least cap rates and maybe drop a little bit? I mean, where you guys stand or how do you use that information?
Well, those are definitely the biggest questions on everybody's minds, our minds, our clients' minds, the portfolio managers' minds. The reality is that this year going forward, looking forward, it's one of the most difficult years that even the professionals have had, because 2022 was obviously a very challenging year for the vast majority of investors, including ours, but less so than most because we've really outperformed the passive strategies and the benchmarks. But the fact is, that this is the year when things are just a little bit more murky than usual, I'll say. And, you've got the bond market anticipating 5 of the last 0 Fed pivots on interest rates. And so the bond market's recovered a little bit here in the last couple of months, still a terrible year. And there's just a lot of confusion around stocks and where is the economy going? Is it a recession? Is it not a recession? Is it a mild one? Is it stagflation? Basically a myriad of unanswered questions, I'll say.
Well, and then I could have added in, and I have earlier in the show, but talking about what the heck's going to happen with China, what the heck's going to happen in Ukraine, and I think there could be many, many surprises coming out of there. It's not like we have wonderful information about what's really going on with China and what they're doing. We don't have great information about the Russian Ukraine situation, and in terms of what's the thinking of Vladimir Putin, for example. So, just name your variable, and it's out there causing a lot of risk. So that begs the question: how do you approach a market with this much volatility? Chaos, as you may know, on Money Talks for 2 years, I said 23 would be worse than 22, more chaotic, more volatile. So, how do you approach that for an individual with their portfolio?
Stick to the fundamentals of what your portfolio structure is, because it's designed to do what you need it to do for you longer term, pre-retirement, during retirement, or education-wise, as the case may be. And make sure that you're not married to any particular set of ideas. Always be prepared to be wrong and know where you're wrong and do something about it. That is risk management. And be nimble. Don't get set in your ways. And a significant part of kind of, I'll say, the amalgam of our portfolio manager's view is that things are going to be choppy. So we think that there's going to be a lot of value added by people or by our portfolio managers kind of selling into the rallies or trimming equity exposure into the rallies and buying back on the dips. And then, you know, writing some covered calls on some dividend paying stocks to add a little bit of income and let things kind of settle out. We're anticipating so many things that we don't know the outcomes from or of yet, of course, because it's the future and that's difficult. But the reality is that you got to stick to the process, be disciplined, don't always be fully invested, and be ready for exogenous events. And the biggest exogenous event on my radar screen is Ukraine.
Yeah, it's interesting. We had had the pleasure of chatting with Frank Giustra going back, I don't know, I'm guessing this now, a month, 5 weeks. But I loved how Frank finished it off. You've got to choose what environment you're in. And I'm hearing this with you, is this is not an environment to try and hit a home run. This is a survival kind of environment. Make careful decisions, understand that there's a lot of risk out there. And that should sort of backstop all of the decisions you're making. And in that line, as you know, I've been incredibly negative on bonds, incredibly mm-hmm. negative, and happily so. You know, I said, lock in all your rates. And I think that's borne out to be the right strategy. Now we come to a time, though, and, you know, you can get paid a little bit for owning a 10-year or a 5-year or 2-year. I personally don't like long-term bonds still. I don't mind, though, if you lock in or not lock in your some flexibility with 1 or 2 years. But where do you guys stand? You did not lose money in the bond market last year. So I bet you're wiping your forehead saying, thank goodness.
Well, I would, just to be precise, we were down very slightly in the bond market, you know, kind of in the 1 to 1.5% range. But that's a heck of a lot better than the benchmarks did, because they were all down double digits, particularly if we go out on the long end of the curve. I mean, TLT, the U.S. 20-plus year Treasury ETF was down over 33% at one point, and I think the end of the third quarter, beginning of the fourth. So, I mean, we protected capital extremely well. But now, yes, even on money market, like even cash, you get paid to wait, so it's a little bit less painful. You don't look at cash as much as a zero return asset, and especially given how quickly a return can evaporate if things get volatile on the stock side of things, you know, some cash is always good. Cash is king, right? Sometimes.
Well, certainly in this environment, it would have paid off. Cash certainly outperformed both bonds and stocks, and that's an important thing to note. Well, let me talk about something else, because when the last time we were on your show and the time before that, and I think the time before that, you know, you were talking about using the commodity market too as a sort of an inverse correlation. It's not correlated to stocks and bonds usually. And, you know, I'm just assuming that side of the portfolio must have done pretty well.
That, in fact, has been the single best part of our client portfolios for the last 2 years. Now, it's kind of 5 to 10% of equity allocations. So it's not the whole portfolio. So I want to keep that in proper context and not give an impression that is overly a positive. But the fact is that since inception, which is March 18th of 2021, the annualized return in that part of our client portfolios is 17.6% versus the benchmark, which is half TSX and half S&P 500. That benchmark was 5.6%. Now, the surprising part of that really has been the fact that the standard deviation, which is a pretty well-accepted measure of volatility, has been lower than those benchmarks. So we've been pleasantly surprised by that. Now, the fact is we think that the trajectory of the commodity space is still going to be positive and a steeper incline than broader equity markets. But we're pretty sure that the honeymoon's over in terms of lower volatility.
And let me come back a little bit further with this, isn't that, okay, so someone sitting here at the beginning of the year, let's walk through very quickly, because I know you've got a webinar coming up that I want to let people know about. It's on Tuesday, January 10th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 6 p.m. Pacific. time. It's free. And you can go to, by the way, you can go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. You'll be able to sign up. It's Tuesday, as I say, 7 p.m. Mountain, 6 p.m. Pacific. You'll be able to walk through a little further. But I'm just saying, I sit here at the beginning of the year. Do I start with, okay, where is my portfolio now? You know, what is my mix now? And then sort of project what you think it should be in terms, and always, as you said right up front, thinking about the risk.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. What you're actually talking about is a process that we go through with our clients. It's not just, you know, how has the portfolio performed in absolute terms and, say, versus a weighted benchmark. So we see if there's value in the way the portfolio is being managed compared to a passive strategy. But most importantly, it's what does this mean to me? And so we go back and we look at financial plans and say, okay, 2022 was a terrible year for the markets overall. It was a slightly negative year for your portfolio. But what does that mean to your family? So we always go back to the plan, right? It's that roadmap. And what we're finding is that even though it was a bad year overall, clients are still on track. Nobody's, you know, off track from becoming or remaining financially independent. And frankly, that is the ultimate measurement of this is, are we going to continue to have enough? Is the portfolio generating sufficient income that you don't have to sell off capital in order to fund a retirement lifestyle expense and that sort of thing? But I mean, that's kind of where we start. It's always in the context of what's most important to you. How does this affect you?
And again, let me just, I should have asked this a little bit earlier, but people want to know usually is what kind of time frame. Like, so for example, you mentioned you could have as much as 10% in commodity sector. And are you sitting there going, got to be there 3 years kind of thing? You got to be there 5 years, you know, whatever it is, as opposed to a trading vehicle.
When the data changes, we change. Mm-hmm. We still think that there's, you know, plenty of runway on the commodity side of things. But the reality is that if that environment does change significantly, we've got risk management on each and every one of the positions that we hold. So we're not dogmatic or ideological about it. We're practical. We're just saying, okay, this looks like it's positioned to continue going up, or it's made a major inflection point, a major bottom. Let's buy it. Or it looks like, you know, things are getting a little bit overdone. Let's pull back and lock in the gains. Like we're up about 28-29% on the gold stocks that we bought back in August. We almost got stopped out in late September, didn't breach the support level, and we held them, and we're glad that we did. But it's all about piece by piece. You do your job, you follow your process, you do your risk management. I know it's boring, but it works.
Well, you got to forgive the cliche, but man, we live in interesting times. And Andrew will get a chance to explain much more at the webinar, which is, again, I'm talking about Tuesday, January 10th, but it's 7 p.m. Mountain, 6 p.m. Pacific. Just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. You got to sign up because obviously, you know, with the technology, there's limited amount of space available. But man, if you're going to pay attention, this is the time of year to do it. Andrew, thanks for sharing your time with us.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Look forward to seeing you in a few weeks in Vancouver.
Well, this is a heck of a shocking stat to start the year off. Some would call it a shocking miracle. I'm talking about the first shipment of LNG, liquid natural gas, was delivered from Louisiana to Germany this week to their brand new floating LNG import terminal. Enough natural gas, by the way, that one load to power 50,000 German homes for a year. The miracle part? The German government first started talking about building a floating terminal in March. Some permits were issued May 1st for a project that is normally estimated to take 5 years, and it's open 8 months later. And this is in a country, think about this one. The new Berlin airport in 2020 was 9 years behind schedule. The Stuttgart's new railway station has been under construction since 2010, still isn't open. Won't until 2025 and is massively over budget. I mean, again, just think about what I'm talking about here. It's the poster child for where there's a will, there's a way. I mean, what's happened when a can-do attitude replaces the can't-do we're so familiar with in Canada? It's what happens when politicians, government bureaucrats, environmental regulations, labor unions become the engine for progress, but not the obstacle. Again, the opposite of what's been happening in Canada. Well, at least before the project is officially canceled. In Germany, it started with short-sighted, ill-conceived energy policies that forced a radical rethink in the face of shortages and brought about a frankness rarely witnessed in politics, exemplified maybe by the German economy minister, Robert Habeck. He's a member of the Green Party, and you hear that right, member of the Green Party. This is what he said. If there's a chance in this really terrible situation, it's that we shake off all the sleepiness and in some cases, grouchiness that exists in Germany. Could you imagine saying that in Canada? Well, I can't imagine saying it in Germany. That clearly happened, though, as the bureaucracy in German parliament, well, they passed the LNG Acceleration Act, speeding up procedures for reviewing, approving, and awarding contracts for the LNG project. Unions, management, engineers, other workers face numerous obstacles, including finding solutions to the problem of a new pipeline that crosses the path of an annual migration of frogs. They also had potentially toxic soil because of the high concentration of sulfuric acid if it's exposed to oxygen. Doesn't matter. But they overcame these obstacles and more with ingenuity and dedication. An incredible accomplishment. Not in 5 years, but 8 months. As I said, some would call it a miracle. But this is what happens when reality, the reality of energy shortages, threatens to devastate both individuals and the economy when it comes along and smacks ideology and virtue signaling into submission. And it stands in sharp contrast to the norm of what we see in this country and throughout Europe. Hey, just a quick note here. You know, if you want to have a terrific new year, make things different in your life, here's one of the things I suggest. I think you have to commit to other people. I think you have to, you can donate money, but you can volunteer in the service of others. Now, I won't go on and on, but I could, believe me, so consider yourself lucky. But in that vein, look, the BC Special Olympics has their first in-person winter games, I think, in about 4 years. And it's being held in Kamloops. By the way, Kamloops does an absolutely fabulous job when it comes to hosting volunteer events. Or, you know, things like a Special Olympics Winter Games. They do it for so many. I know high school basketball championships I've attended there for that and many others, as I say. All you have to do is go to sobcgameskamloops.ca and register to become a volunteer. They need 500 or something like this. I don't know. It's a huge number. But I guarantee this, you'll get a real kick out of it. I'm sure most people have never attended, you know, sort of a Special Olympics event. You'll never see more joyful athletes. It is so inspiring. It's wonderful, but they need your help. So if you live in that area, consider helping out. And I promise you, you'll get the bang for the buck. It sends out huge positive karma for you. But just go to sobcgameskamloops.ca. One word, sobcgameskamloops.ca. You can register, and I'm telling you, it'll be a terrific experience. Well, this is hardly the way to welcome the new year, but it's a fact of life. That is, if you own a home, chances are you've got your property assessment, certainly in different parts of the country, different processes. But Ozzy, I got Ozzy Jurek with me, ozbuzz.ca. Ozzy, I'm just saying, you know, that's the time of year I can get indigestion when I look at my property assessment and I don't agree with it and all of that stuff. But I guess the first point we should make is people have got them probably across the country.
No question about January the 4th, they were sent out in Alberta and in BC. The interesting thing is that in BC, at the bcassessment.ca website, you guys can type in any address, particularly your address, get the assessments, and also get an idea on how the assessor arrived at the price that they put on your house. Now, there are a kicker here.
Well, I was just going to say, can I do anybody's house, or will they ask me sort of some sort of identification that it's my house? Like, could I do yours, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes, you could. You can type in, but only for a short period of time. That's why I'm saying now is sort of the time that you should really take a good hard look at your assessments for several reasons, but you can do so at the great BC Assessment website. They also show you sales, and you get a good sense of the value, because the kicker, Mike, is that the value that you have on your piece of paper that they say your house is worth, that's what the city bases the taxes on. So you should really make sure that you agree with that. And secondly, most people don't realize the value is not as of today. It's as of July 1, 2022. And you and I have, every radio show since February, reported the numbers, right? 50,000 down, 50,000 down, 50,000 down. And since July, we've seen a substantial decline. So yeah, this is a different year than any other. The reason is so fast, the decline. Look, the average house on the West Side was a 3.8 million July 1, as per the real estate board. And in January 1, it's 3,416,000. That's a $405,000 difference that you have to pay taxes on if you don't do anything about it. And West Van is 3.4 million to 2.9, again, close to 500,000. And even on Vancouver East, from 1,900,000 to 1,700,000 is a $200,000 difference. So it behooves you to look at that.
Well, and again, many markets like ours, Hamilton, Montreal, Toronto, not so much in Alberta, though, at least if I'm getting my assessment in Calgary and Edmonton, I haven't experienced the same level of decline. But will their comeback be if I say, hey, look, you've got this wrong? Will their comeback be, no, it's fine up until July? You know, will I have to argue July 1st, if you know what I mean? Well, that's what I faced. I say, no, that's what it was on July 1st. Too bad.
Well, first of all, I want to make sure that on July 1st, that your numbers show, and you can do the comparison with your friendly realtor to say what actually was the average price in my area. Because if you just take a price, and that's why a little talk with an assessor can clarify that. Did anything happen in your house? Did you make any renovation? Did you have a flood? Did you have all sorts of things that he will listen to you. He wants to make sure he makes assessment. But the value is recent sales of comparable houses, right? And that's what you want to make sure that you have before you talk to them.
Okay, well, let's hope this is clear. Check your assessment. Don't just leave it, say, oh, that's it. No, make sure it's something in the ballpark that you think it should be. Okay, step two, what do you do then if you disagree?
Well, like I said, call them up. I'll make it an email first before you go to an official complaint. But if you don't get satisfaction because you don't feel that in your area that is the wrong assessment, and for your house it's the wrong assessment, all the houses that they're using have double garage, you only have a single garage, whatever it is that your complaint is, trying to do it by phone or email. If that doesn't work very quickly, they only have till January 31st in BC to file an official notice of complaint, the appeal. So that's very important. After January 31st, forget it. You can't dispute it.
And I guess I'll just share from my experience, the number of times there is something to dispute is huge. I mean, they're making broad-based sort of decisions on averages and things like that. A whole bunch of factors go into it. But a lot of time, I've just known too many people who said, this is crazy what I've got here. This just, it's not right. I've certainly experienced that about 3-4 times in my life where it just felt way out of whack. So, I mean, the first thing is make sure you do check it out. If you do have an issue, then as Ozzy says, email, if not call. And then, I want you to reiterate those dates because what Calgary is, or sorry, Alberta is different. I think it's 60 days from when you get the, the assessment.
And right. And in Calgary, it's March 13th. In Edmonton, it's March 24th. And Toronto has a very clear, they have a 4-year assessment cycle. And then the tax bill is calculated by multiplying the current year phased-in property assessment value as determined by the MPAC, the council-approved city tax rate, the city building fund levy, and the education tax rate. All that has to be disputed by March 31st.
Well, okay, that's our message. So get on it, everybody. And, you know, speaking of the market, so Ozzy, I know we're going to get preliminary numbers here. It's a little bit slower because of the Christmas break and New Year's, et cetera. But it's not like we're seeing some slowdown in the decline. You know, I mean, I know you were talking on ozbuzz.ca about Surrey, for example. You know, a huge municipality. And, man, that continuation of their decline is right there with us.
Particularly in the single family home market. We talked about it on the show several times. The average price in February, the high was $1,925,000. Now it's $1,385,000. That's a huge decline of $540,000. I think it's coming time closely to be finding a new bottom. And that's the key I want to talk about at the World Outlook Conference, that, you know, when everybody's running away because of the numbers, and I tell you, Mike, the numbers are going to look a lot worse. The general media will discover that when you compare the right kind of months, it'll look terrible. The February over February number will show a 30% decline. Probably, Mike, that's the time where most buyers should be buying. Mm-hmm. But that'll scare us even more. We got a three-day cooling period. The active listings are up by 135%. The sales are down 60%. The psychology is awful. let's not buy. Let's wait for the market where we can pay 100,000 more than the guy wants, right? But anyways, what we'll talk about at the World Outlook Conference, that in my experience, the time once the decline, that the fast, fast increase in the market has a fast, fast decline, it's almost textbook, and it finds a new level, and we won't be too far away from that.
Well, I'm looking forward to that too myself. I always take a ream of notes when you're talking about it and you make recommendations, et cetera. But your point is so well taken. You know, it's interesting, as you always say, we wrestle each other to the floor in our living room to make an offer that's above ask, you know, when times are hot. And hey, no, I'm not interested at this point. And I think that's something to really pay attention to with this. In the meantime, Ozzie, look, I got one more thing. Do you mind? You got another minute. Remember we talked about that 3-day cooling period in British Columbia. It's not apropos for other people, but just give me the quick down and dirty on that 3-day cooling period now if I'm a buyer.
Well, the buyer now has the right to walk away from an offer that he made and got accepted by the for 3 days. And you know, probably that would have been a good idea 2 years ago, but today the market is already cooled enough. The buyer has all the time in the world to do his assessments. But the little fun twist is that if he gives notice, he has to pay the owner a 0.25% fee for that. So on a $1 million house, it'll cost him $2,500 to walk away. Now, I really don't understand the logic. I mean, you know, why don't I sit down with my realtor and I, subject to financing time and subject to inspection, subject to all that, like which is part of the legislation now. But it'll be an interesting exercise.
Well, as I say, we'll have a chance to talk about it further, but that's just come into play. People have questions about it, but they can also, you'll write about it on ozbuzz.ca. People can go on there, ozbuzz.ca. In the meantime, I hope we have a terrific, and I hope you and your family have a terrific 2023.
Thank you, Mike. And you know, look, the resolutions work. Last year's resolution I had was to lose 20 pounds by Christmas, and I only have 30 pounds to go.
I know the feeling. There you go, Ozzie Girard. I want to bring in Victor Adair now live from the trading desk. Vic, I was sort of smiling looking at Friday's trading action, market action, because we get one report coming out, and I think it was a jobs report, and the market had a big smile on its face. And then we got another report about a few hours later, and that smile was wiped off the face. I mean, it was just the volatility of it.
Yeah, the short-term volatility continues. The employment report, as you say, it looked, both in Canada and the United States, it looked like strong economies, and people are going, oh my God, you know, if we could only get the economy weakened, then the Fed would ease off and, you know, all the road would be paved with roses. The ISM report came out an hour and a half later, and it delivered the message, really, that services inflation is starting to trend down. Now, that has been the sticky point. We've seen goods inflation is definitely coming down, but the thought was that services, which is going to include wages, was sticking up, staying up there. So anyway, what that meant was that the U.S. dollar got sold, stocks got bid, and the bond market loved it. So yeah, short-term chop in the market continues, but we've just had this, like for instance, the Canadian dollar has been locked in a 1 cent range for a month. And the same sort of thing goes for the stock market and even the bond market. We've been chopping back and forth in short-term ranges.
You know, it's, speaking of that, I mean, one of the primary things I look at is how, when someone says, what's gold going to do? All they're really asking me is more money going to flow in than flow out. What, the stocks, more money going to flow in than flow out. And that's something that you and I have been chronicling here on the show, in how much money was coming out of Europe. So they bought the U.S. dollar, then bought U.S. stocks, treasuries. You know, in the meantime, they had to sell the euro. So we've seen that action for the better part. Well, I'd have to look at my charts, but the better part of a year, that's been one of the main dynamics. And I'm just wondering, are you seeing any sign that that's changing? Because, you know, I think the U.S. dollar is still, now we're a few months away from when it made that 20-year high.
Yeah, well, you know, if you take a long-run view on things, the NASDAQ was the hottest stock market in the world by a country mile, from the lows in 2009 to the highs in 2021. I mean, it was so far ahead of everything else, nothing else was even in the race. And then we had a weak stock, a NASDAQ last year. A good part of that is foreign capital coming to America, because not only is the stock market going up, but in their base currency, it goes up even more. Then at some point, you have to think, well, what happens then if the capital starts to go the other way? So, you know, there's always those ebbs and flows, and where are we in the ebb and flow? The U.S. dollar made a 20-year high in September. Since then, it's weakened a bit. And I've been noticing with the data that I can see that speculators have jumped all over the long side of the euro. The European stocks have gone up more in the last couple of months than American stocks. And I'm wondering, are we starting to see an early sign of, let's say, of capital reversing flows? I mean, we've had this picture in our mind that Europe was just a disaster. You know, they'd hooked their wagon to the Russian energy and you couldn't get anything done in Europe and so on and so on. And therefore, the euro got to a 20-year low against the U.S. dollar in September. So maybe had gone too far. And you and I often talk about that. Yeah, you can have a view on the market, but is it already priced in? So I can't tell you where it's going from here. I mean, I don't know, but what I see is this choppiness continues and there's good reason for it.
By the way, I just want to reemphasize that point because that seems to be a difficult one that people say, here's a piece of news and whatever market they're following doesn't move. And it's hard to understand. Oh, people had already bet on that. You know, and it's only when you surprise. And I think in Europe, one of the issues is the big shock has to have been the warm weather. You know, I mean, it's breaking temperature records. You know, I looked at Berlin a couple of days ago and it was like summer, you know, and many other examples. It was throughout Europe, which means ergo, they're not going to see that gas shortage because demand for gas went down so dramatically, you know, and storage went up, all of that stuff. So maybe things aren't quite as bad as we anticipated. And I'm not so sure that wouldn't have propelled the market a little bit higher.
So here's where I come from as a trader. And, you know, you might say, oh, you're just being contrary or ornery or whatever. But I see this short-term sort of love affair that's happened with all things European over the past couple of months. And I was thinking, and I wrote in my blog last week that, yeah, last year it was all about the Fed. How about it's not all about the Fed this year? Maybe what would the alternative be? Well, how about geopolitical? And I mean, the first thing you got to think of is the war between Russia and Ukraine. So while, you know, the European stock markets have had this rally, the euro has had a great rally, the orneriness in me says, you know, I don't think this is a good time to be long the euro currency or basically anything European relative to America if I've got a choice. Because there's this unquantifiable risk on their eastern borders. And I think the Western press has kind of given us the idea that the Ukrainians are punching way above their weight. They're doing real well. And there's a secret side of us that just wants the Russians to get clobbered anyway. And they're doing it. And maybe we're wrong. You know, I don't know, but maybe we're wrong.
Well, plus it's so difficult without getting accurate information, without getting full information, no matter how hard you try, you can't get it. I mean, you know, the report earlier this week, I saw that Vladimir Putin had cancer and he's going to die in 10 minutes. You know, I mean, those are the kind of things that start invading the market at that point. And then there's that assumption, if something happened to Putin, that someone better would come in. I don't know where that assumption comes from. You know, why would we think that? Maybe somebody even more hardline. So I'm just trying to, maybe not particularly eloquently, but, you know, emphasizing your point. It's the unknowns out there, especially when it comes to the Ukraine, the geopolitical situation.
You know, I wrote a paragraph or two about propaganda in my blog last week. And I mean it in the simplest way. You know, people don't know who or what to believe anymore. I mean, the propaganda has become so sophisticated. So, you know, what I try to do is I look at the news flow. It can't help but have an opinion. But more and more, I just have to look at the price and trade the price action. And if I'm wrong on something, even if it goes against my views, I say, well, but, you know, this I'm wrong and take it off. It to try to believe a story. And, you know, to dig in your heels when it's going against you, you know, whatever, you know, you bought the marijuana stocks at the top of the goofy rally and you just know it's going to come back and go higher and higher. But, you know, a couple of months later, you're so far behind on the position. I'm just giving an example, that kind of thing. I don't know what's going to happen. It seems very confusing to me. I trade the price action. I trade it pretty carefully. And I see, Mike, you know, I mean, even with my RSP, or it's not an RSP anymore. It's a RIF now, right? You get older. I can move some money into, you know, two-year notes or GICs or whatever and get paid 4 or 5% without taking a lot of risk. Maybe that's not a bad idea.
Certainly echoing what Lance Roberts and I were saying just a few minutes ago. As I say, it's a fascinating environment. There's so many variables interacting there, Vic. But the good news is you'll be at the World Outlook Conference. I hope more data will be available. You'll be with us next week. It's the kind of environment that people have to stay on top of.
Well, I'm really looking forward to being at the WAC with you, Mike, especially, you know, we're in person this year. I think that's terrific.
I think people are looking forward to chatting with you and Michael and Ozzy. Not so much me. Yeah, so the good-looking Victor Adair will be there. It is her chance to chat and ask personally about things that are happening. And as I say, the countdown's on, mikesmoneytalks.ca, February 3rd and 4th. And I won't see you before then, Vic, of course, because you're over in mid-Vancouver Island. And so I look forward to actually seeing you there. That'll be great.
Me too.
Time now for this week's Goofy Award. Actually, it's the first Goofy of the year. You know, just before Christmas, Joe Rogan had Harvard visiting professor, and he's a modern slavery activist. His name is Siddharth Kara. He had him on his podcast, incredibly successful podcast, but he's talking about child forced labor in the Congo used in mining, but especially mining cobalt, which is used for every lithium ion battery. I mean, you could be talking electric vehicles, computers, cell phones. 70% of the lithium comes from using child labor in the Congo. But the goofy part is that the story went viral. It was reported in major mainstream media, as well as social media, as if it was breaking news. I mean, really? Cobalt is used in my cell phone, electric car battery, is produced by child labor in the Congo? I mean, come on. On Money Talks, as well as every other place that bothers to get past the EV virtue signaling and ask some straightforward questions like, where are the raw materials coming from? Everybody there knew it. A question that still comes to mind, though, and doesn't come to mind, rather, for people who are covering this story. I mean, look at Environment Minister Guilbeault's recent announcement that 2026, 20% of new vehicles must be electric, 60% of sales in 2030, and 100% of vehicle sales must be electric by 2035. There is no way that won't involve child labor in the manufacturing. You know, as Professor Kara accurately puts it, there's no clean cobalt. But my point is, that's been known for years. I mean, literally everyone in the production of batteries knows it's been, you know, it's been years that that's been known, but it's been ignored, is my point, by climate change activists from the get-go, as well as politicians and major manufacturers like Apple or Tesla. It's like one of those dirty little secrets that everyone who cares to know knows it. But we don't talk about it because politicians or maybe the manufacturers know that forced child labor is a price most of us are not willing to pay to drive an electric vehicle. And by the way, there's so many other examples. I mean, we could go to solar panels. As we've been talking about for a number of years on Money Talks, China dominates the supply chain for solar. As Bloomberg reports, just under half of the world's solar-grade polysilicone supply needed to make solar panels is made using millions of enslaved Uyghur and Kazakh citizens in China. And again, anyone who cared to know already knew that. We got Mark Widmark, for example, is the chief executive of U.S.-based manufacturer First Solar. He says, exposure to Xinjiang and slave labor is the unfortunate reality for most of the industry. But maybe when Joe Rogan does something on that, there'll be shock and awe. I mean, there's just so many aspects to this, but it's typical. The superficiality, the refusal to look at the practicalities, the emphasis on virtue signaling and so many aspects of the green agenda. We need to change that because I'm hoping that in 2023, we're going to say enough already. Enough with the virtue signaling and demand a reality check regarding the practicalities for every statement and demand we hear in the climate change agenda. I mean, excuses for turning a blind eye to labor practices used to mine necessary materials for EVs as well as wind and solar, that wore thin years ago, even thinner when it came to the absence of a workable plan with details of a workable timeline and production of the resources needed before switching to a renewable grid. Hey, that's all the time I have this week, but I want to remind you, we've got the World Outlook Conference coming up Lots of great stuff. I know I talk about it, but I think it's an opportunity. You know, as I said right in the outset of the show, I'm concerned about what we're going to see in 2023. I'm confident in the kinds of things that we've been saying is coming forward. We've seen consistency in 2022 with our main themes. And as I said, you know what? Hey, the world isn't coming to an end. No, it's not. But it's changing. And those people who do not recognize the change are likely in big trouble financially, as we've seen in this past year. So that's just my plea for you to join us. I look forward to it. You know, World Outlook Conference, February 3rd and 4th. Simple to do. Go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. It's a great weekend. We've got some fabulous people coming. And I think it's rare that you get to hear this caliber of person and people. But it's also the track record that I'm proud of. That's our goal. Get things right. And we've got the people to do it. As I say, February 2nd, 3rd and 4th, mikesmoneytalks.ca. And in the meantime, I can't encourage you. Every week I feel more like this. You've got to join us on Money Talks tweets or Michael Campbell's Money Talks on Facebook or on mikesmoneytalks.ca. The amount of stuff, information that is not in the mainstream media that has a direct impact on these trends and on your personal finances is increasingly dramatic. So take advantage of it. You know, it's got the right price. That's free. So join us. And in the meantime, I hope you have a terrific week.
This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell, available at mikesmoneytalks.ca or through your favorite podcast subscription service. Join us on Facebook at Michael Campbell's Money Talks and on Twitter at Money Talks Tweet.